Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What have the baby boomers done for America? And what have they done to America? And what makes them so different from any generation before or since? Born a little over 2 years after the end of World War II, P.J. O'Rourke grew up with the first of the baby boomers in a society elevated by optimism and empowered by unprecedented economic prosperity. Now in his 60s, he's decided it's time to take stock of the ways his outsized generation has shaped the world. P.J. O'Rourke is H.L. Mencken Fellow at the Cato Institute, contributing editor at the Weekly Standard, and of course a regular panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. His new book is called The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault, and I'll Never Do It Again. P.J., welcome back to Think. So you have said that the baby boom was a carefully conducted science experiment. What makes now a good time to evaluate the results?
We're turning 50. The very youngest baby boom, members of the baby boom, are turning 50 this year. The generation that would never grow up, we're all old.
Everybody is too old to be trusted, according to earlier members of your generation.
Well, fortunately, it was not a member of our generation that said that. I'm trying to remember who it was. It was some flaky young demonstrator at Berkeley who was himself about 27 when he said it and has been mercilessly teased ever since about it. I wish I could recall his name. It's in the book. You'll have to buy the book to find out the guy's name. But I did research who said that. And like many of the major players in the 60s, he was not a baby boomer at all. He was a member of the so-called silent generation.
Baby boomers were raised to believe that every dream they had was possible. Has that been a good thing overall?
Well, no.
Optimism is for the birds.
Yeah, that turns out not to be true, you know, and I'm careful with my own kids. Like, you can be anything you want except, you know, an NFL football player, you know, or an Olympic pole vaulter, you know, or, you know, maybe, you know, if you work really hard at pole vaulting, I don't know. But, you know, I do always try and temper that with a little humor with our kids because there was a little bit too big a dose of that, I think, back in the 50s and early 60s. That, you know, it got to the point where it was the slogan of the Army, for gosh sake, you know, be all you can be.
I'm always fascinated by the fact that, you know, the boomers were indulged, at least to an extent that had been unprecedented in American life, in part because their parents had more money and they felt like we were in a good place.
In world historical life,
yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's a surprising interlude in American life. It's a shocking interlude in the history of civilization as we know it. We have about 15, 18 years there of really like an excellent economy and steady economic growth within that excellent economy. There is peace as we knew it. There wasn't, of course. There was the Korean War in the middle of that, but it was we were a little too young, the baby boom, for that to register much on our radar. Even though I had a cousin who was over there in the Marine Corps and was involved in that retreat from the Yalu River, nearly died. It really wasn't there, and we had this kind of. We were still in two-parent families. All the social stability, you know, that the 19th century was so proud of still obtained in this part of the 20th century. All the really horrifying events of the first half of the 20th century seemed to be over. Yeah, there was the threat of atomic bombs, but we were pretty sure they only killed grown-ups.
It would seem that that would be an unlikely generation to turn around and bite the hand that fed it.
So you would think, although, you know, we all know, of course, none of us spoil our own children, but
right.
We all know people who do spoil theirs.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And those children often turn out to be remarkably ungrateful. And I think we as a generation were ungrateful. And not only were we ungrateful, but we've been told it was a perfect world. And when we, of course, encountered the actual world and found that it was imperfect, as the world always is, we were mad about it. We had a tantrum, you know. So, you know, it's a little silly, and a lot of us would like to be able to go back in time and shake the hands of those greatest generation parents, many of whom my own included, are not with us anymore.
Yeah. Well, was there a point, do you think, as a generation that everyone thought, oh my gosh, my parents, you know, did the best they could, even if it wasn't perfect?
Yeah, but it was about last week. It's coming a little late, you know. Either you're going out to the cemetery to say thank you, you know, or you're going to the rest home and they can't remember who you are to say thank you. I've managed to say a few thanks. I'm actually going this weekend to celebrate my godmother's 100th birthday.
Wow.
And she is still very much with it, and so I've gotten to say thanks to her, but I never got to say thanks to my own folks.
It's pretty amazing that, okay, so the baby boomers are sort of divided now. Some of you are, you know, have raised your Gen X kids. Some of you are raising millennials, which I know you are.
Yeah, I am.
And I wonder how different you think baby boomers have been as parents than their own parents were.
You know, I think we turned out to be really good parents, a little on the overcautious, a little on the helicoptery side. Mm-hmm. But then two things about that. One thing's, as the generation that never grew up, we know what the little devils are thinking. So don't try pull any stuff like I remember smoking pot in the basement, my mom standing at the top of the stairs and going, "Pat, is there something on fire down there?" Well, of course there was, but right. Nothing that was going to damage my brain, but it wasn't going to damage the house. We knew what they were up to. And then, of course, with the helicopter parent thing is it does take two to tango here.
Mm-hmm.
My generation would have gone out with a emotional stinger missile and shot that helicopter down, you know, the kids today. But I honestly think when I talk to I've got 13 and 16-year-old daughters, and I can talk to them about practically anything. You know, there are a few things I don't talk to them about, you know, like boys.
They probably don't want you to anyway.
No. They definitely, I can tell they don't want me to go there. I just remind them that, you know, Dad's an old Republican. We live out in the country. I have guns.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I cannot imagine my grandmother, who would be 100 if she were still with us, going out and buying like a Rolling Stones album to relate to my dad. And yet it's not been so strange for the boomers and the millennials and Gen Xers as parents and children to share cultural touchstones.
Not at all. And it's remarkable how little the culture has changed in a way. I mean, I go to my daughter's high school. Or I go to, you know, college campuses sometimes to give talks and stuff. And in many ways, it's very similar to the 1960s. And if I think about the time lapse there, it's as though I'd shown up in high school in the 1960s. And, you know, the big question was, should girls bob their hair? And everybody was doing the Charleston and wearing raccoon coats. You know? I think how little. I mean, you know, they're a little more tattooed and pierced than we were, but they're both, you know, still playing hacky sack. And, you know, the music. They think, it's, of course, the music is terrifically different, but it doesn't sound so very different to me. And they actually still listen to stuff that we were listening to that our parents were going, that's just noise.
Right. Of course, they listen to it.
Yeah, there's a much closer bond with the generations.
Yeah, it's strange to think about, you know, a nursing home hiring like a Doors cover band to entertain the residents. But at some point in the future, that might be exactly what we have.
I would say probably just right about now. It would be is when that is happening. Old friend of mine and I have had a standing joke for a while about, you know, the sort of like we're going to open a rest home for our generation, you know, down on some lawless island in the Caribbean, you know, where there will be lots of pot smoking and, you know, and hot young attendants. So we won't be in any shape to do anything about the hot young attendants. It'll be strictly decorative sort of stuff. But, you know, we'll be, you know, out there on the porch getting blasted and, you know, playing the music really, really loud because we'll be deaf. And then the other day I realized I'm 66. I better get moving on this
get
project.
Get on it.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, some of the rules that your generation overturned were overturned because they needed to be. It seems that the baby boomers made great strides in, you know, you talk about world poverty. I think there was progress made against sort of casual racism everywhere in the society. Those are good things.
They are. Actually, I think we've turned out to be a great generation. I really think it's a nicer, gentler world that we live in. Not everywhere, of course, but I mean, where the baby boom or baby boom-like societies obtain, you know, it's you're right. The casual hatred is gone. You know, we didn't do the heavy lifting. We have a tendency to take credit for things like the civil rights movement. We didn't do that. That was people much older than us.
Yeah.
You know? Feminism, as a matter of fact, the all-important second wave of feminism, Gloria Steinem. Gloria was, I know Gloria, she's from the same hometown as I am, from Toledo, Ohio. And you would think when Gloria and I would get together, you know, I'm pretty conservative and she's obviously not, and you'd think we would argue politics, but we talk about Toledo, Ohio is what we talk about, where we're both from. But it was an older generation that did most of the really important things. But we're the ones who internalized it. We're the ones who, like, really, in our self-absorbed way, we made for give the world a drug and a hug. That's our motto.
My guest is P.J. O'Rourke. He is a regular panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and an H.L. Mencken, the H.L. Mencken Fellow at the Cato Institute. His new book is called The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault, and I'll Never Do It Again. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to talk to PJ, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with P.J. O'Rourke. He is a contributing editor at the Weekly Standard and a panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. He's got a new book out as well. It's called The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault, and I'll Never Do It Again. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. PJ, what kind of role did TV play in shaping your worldview as a kid?
Well, I think it was one of the things that made the baby boom generation unusually unitary. That it gave us, we had very similar experiences growing up. The vast majority of us were some kind of middle class. Television had just come along, so where I lived, we only got one station. I think, you know, you'd max out around four, you know, and one of which, no offense to, you know, was educational TV, which no one in their right mind would watch. Although when we first got our we got our first television set in time to watch the 1950 presidential election. I myself wasn't all that interested, but 1952. Excuse me, I'm getting my years off. And but I'd watch anything on that, even the presidential convention. I'd watch the test pattern. I'd watch Mass for Shut-ins. I'd watch Farm Prices. You know, this is fascinating to have this box with pictures on it. So we all got the same input from that. Post-war society was, of course, it was not perfectly uniform. And you know, I mean, this is a humorous book. I cannot speak to what it was like to be poor and black or Hispanic or even female for that matter. And I really don't try. I try for the things that where we were most alike. And we were mostly in the suburbs. We were mostly in two-parents families. We were mostly middle class, although the middle class was very modest in those days. It wasn't that we were rich. We were rich by world historical standards. We had the same TV and radio programs. We all saw the same. There's one movie theater in the neighborhood. We all saw the same movies. It was probably the last generation that will have that unity of mass media. We went to public schools.
Mm-hmm.
The public schools were all alike. You know, the Catholic schools were just public schools with hitting. Knuckles slapped. We mostly went to big coeducational state colleges. Maybe the kids on the East Coast and the West Coast sampled marijuana a year earlier than those of us out in Ohio, but only a year. And there were only a few radio stations. We listened to the same music. So we're all a lot alike in a way I don't think that probably millennials probably don't feel the same way.
Did you feel alike as a teenager, as a young man, or did it feel like everybody was really different and you could express however you wanted to be in the world?
We were definitely all felt alike about us all being different and unique. Mm-hmm. We were all unique in exactly the same way at exactly the same time. No, it was kind of a standing joke in places like, sometimes not joke, but it was kind of a standing trope in things like Time magazine and Life magazine and so on, you know, that we were this generation of fads. We all got a hula hoop at the same time. You know, we all did this, all grew our hair out at the same time. And so, I mean, there was a sense, even at the time, that we were a generation that was very much alike. And then, of course, we weren't. There are those of us who went to Vietnam and those of us who didn't. That was a very, very big difference. But it's interesting to me, as a big anti-war protester and somebody who frankly dodged the draft, that I have never heard a harsh word from the friends that I have who are veterans of the Vietnam War. To a man, and of course it is mostly men, they will say to you, "In miss anything, you are well out of it." You know, lucky. They might go so far as "lucky you," but not "you SOB, you dodge." You know, you didn't do your duty. You know, we were out there protecting the nation, and what were you doing? You know, growing your hair long. You know, and like chanting LBJ. How many kids did you kill today?
Yeah.
That kind of animus between segments of the baby boom does not exist.
Well, that speaks to a sort of empathy. Doesn't it?
It does. I mean, we're a very empathetic generation. I have a theory on this. I wish I'd had this theory when I was writing the book. It's sort of something that I guess I had to write the book to understand the theory, that on a kind of emotional and personal level, we illustrate what Adam Smith was trying to point out on an economic level in The Wealth of Nations. In The Wealth of Nations, he points out that everybody works for their own benefit, that people are selfish in the marketplace, that the butcher and the brewer and the baker don't provide you with things, you know, to make them you feel good. You know, they do this all for profit. And yet you put it all together and it benefits mankind. The baby boom is a very self-absorbed a generation, and sort of emotionally, not so much materially, but sort of emotionally selfish or self-centered or something. And yet when you put it all together, it ends up working for the benefit of mankind. How? I'm not sure I can quite explain that mystery any more than Adam Smith was able to quite explain that mystery about economics in The Wealth of Nations.
Help me understand the political climate among young people when you were young yourself, because I was born in San Francisco in 1970. My parents had moved out there a year before, and people hear that and they make automatic assumptions. But my mom and dad were young Republicans. Not everybody was a hippie.
They still existed.
There
was, however, pretty strong unity on the opposition to the war in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Partly because our generation on the higher plane, our generation seemed to have a kind of gut understanding that this was a wrong move. Even if we fancied ourselves to be very anti-communist, even if we were members of Young Americans for Freedom or something, which I most certainly was not, there was very early on there was a suspicion that a wrong move, maybe not strategically but tactically, getting involved in this Vietnam was not good. After all, it was Bill Buckley was an early critic at the National Review, was an early critic of the war of Vietnam. There was a lot of criticism on the right as well as on the left. But true, we are politically all over the map. We were back then, and we remain so. And if you we've had three baby boomer presidents so far, and we may get more. But we've got Bill Clinton, we've got George W. Bush, and we have, of course, Barack Obama. Now, if you map those three guys out politically, you have to go to Pyongyang to find politics that are more different than these three.
Yeah.
And that, you know, the baby boom there, you know, people say, well, what's the baby boom politics? And they go, they don't have any, you know. I mean, they don't have any identifiable politics. It's Tea Party. It's Occupy Wall Street. It's all over the place.
It would seem that your generation was also the first to be sort of liberated sexually and not stick to the old standards of doing things a certain way with regard to relationships.
We invented sex. we did. We invented sex, and I can prove this to you. Before us, babies actually were found under cabbage leaves. We invented sex, and all I ask anybody, perhaps you're too young for this, but I ask any member of the baby boom to, now, okay, imagine your parents having sex. It didn't happen, right? It just never happened. We invented sex. No, I think what happened was that we sort of hit the trifecta on this. As a matter of fact, our parents, the greatest generation, had been loads more sexually active than their parents. This sexual revolution had been coming for several generations, but in the throes of the Depression and under the stresses of World War II, our parents were, you know, they didn't talk about it, and mm-hmm. and they didn't go public with it, but their behavior, and I mean, there's one little significant statistic in there, is that the divorce rate in 1946 was higher than it would get until the baby boom started getting divorced itself in the 1970s. It was very high, and why it was very high was because, you know, a lot of guys came home from a couple years overseas to find that they had a one-year-old kid. And variance on that scenario.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the pill. Mm-hmm. Effective birth control, effective non-invasive, if you will. a birth control that didn't, like, kill the mood was invented, you know, and became legal in 1962. It became FDA approved in 1962. So those two factors went together. I guess we just hit the bifecta, or whatever that's called. We hit the daily double of two things coming together. Changes that had already happened just weren't being talked about. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, Playboy magazine was not put on the market for the baby boom. I mean, the first issue came out in 1956. You know, we didn't even care about that stuff yet, you know. The greatest generation and the silent generation had really changed these things, and we were the beneficiaries of it.
The country's highest crime rates also happened when the boomers were young adults. How do you account for that in this generation that valued peace and love and empathy?
Drugs. Drugs. I really think that you will see a very close tie-in. There are two things that the baby boom's got to be like think carefully about what we left to the country. One is the single parent families. I mean, the sort of irresponsibility of the baby boom and the idea of just of no dad showing up or dad clearing out, no dad in the picture. This is not good. And the other thing is drugs. Our experiment with drugs was like, let it be a warning to generations to come hereafter. It didn't work. The net results were not good. And you see them particularly, I think, in the crime rates. A lot of that high crime had to do all kinds of, you know, burglary, robbery, mayhem, and murder. So much of it had to do with the drug situation, and then what didn't had to do with like the children raised without the kind of supervision that we had. On the other hand, drugs were not without their benefits. Taught an entire generation the metric system. I sure didn't know what a gram was. You know? And in fairness, it taught the baby boom something about brain chemistry. I mean, we have a kind of acceptance of certain types of mental problems, depression, anxiety, and so on. We know how delicate the brain chemistry is because we messed with it over mm-hmm. and over again. I've got a psychiatrist friend who says when he treats prescribes drugs for people who have anxiety or obsessive compulsive disorder or depression or the, you know, other diseases that can, mental diseases that can be treated fairly easily with drugs these days, said all of his patients who were born before 1946, the first thing they ask him is, "Doc, when can I get off these drugs?" And all the patients that were born after 1946, the first thing they ask is, "Doc, when can I get more?" we did do that, but the sort of mess we made of the family, you know, I mean, it's very amusing when we watch Modern Family, but we did kind of make a mess of the family, and that mess is being repaired. Which is, you know, one of the reasons that I can't imagine, I'm quite conservative Republican, but I just can't imagine anybody being against gay marriage. I mean, whatever brings more love into the world, whatever brings more stability into the world and provides, you know, an environment for kids, not to get all serious on anybody right here, but I just can't imagine being against it on any grounds. And I'm Catholic, too, you know, so I got three strikes against me here on this issue, but I cannot imagine not being in favor of it.
How do you like Pope Francis?
He seems to be a good guy. I haven't talked to him personally. He doesn't, he doesn't write. Yeah, I was saying, actually said something about this the other day. It's really popular with liberal Catholics, almost as popular as the Dalai Lama. you know, I think he's got the whole thing about the, you know, I have a very, very Catholic father-in-law, and I mean, really observes all the holy days of obligation, and, you know, he goes to Mass no matter what, every Sunday, and does everything he's supposed to do. Still not sure he shouldn't stick to fish on Friday. But he always says, always have to remember the church is an institution of men. It's not God who's sitting there in the chair, you know, with the funny hat. I think Pope Francis has that figured out. The encyclical he did on economics showed that he had paid about as much attention in economics class as I did. So I'm not sure I'm down with him on that exactly, but you know, he seems to be at least he's a good guy, and he's got the humility thing going, and that can't be bad.
How did the boomers change the way Americans feel about religion and expressions of faith and the kinds of options you think that are available to us?
Yeah, well, I mean, we certainly expanded what is out there in the way of faith. Sometimes we expanded it to the point where it disappeared completely. There are, you know, way too many, to my mind, atheists and sort of deep agnostics running around in the baby boom. We did point out, I think successfully, that church was really boring, you know, and that if you want to, like, give your thanks to a deity that you respect or in some way, you know, sort of show that you understand that there is some greater intelligence out there. I've always found, like, it's never been hard for me to believe in a greater intelligence than my own, I'll tell you that. maybe some people are just smarter than I am and they have trouble figuring, you know, thinking about. That the mainstream, especially the mainstream Protestant church and the sort of automatic kind of Latin mass, the sort of mechanistic ways of showing faith were, people had pointed out before that maybe these weren't spiritually the best thing, but we were the first generation to point out, they're boring, really boring. You are boring me so much now.
And it doesn't have to be, is your point, I guess.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't think, you know. I mean, here is, like, you know, the most powerful entity in the universe, you know, and you're going to say hello to him. It shouldn't be a boring experience, should it? <you know? laughs>
My guest is P.J. O'Rourke. He is H.L. Mencken Fellow at the Cato Institute, a contributing editor at the Weekly Standard, and a regular panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. His new book is called The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault, and I'll Never Do It Again. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with writer P.J. O'Rourke, whose new book is called The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault, and I'll Never Do It Again. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. That's where we find Justin on the line in Coppell. Hi, Justin.
Hi. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Welcome.
Love the show, and love P.J. O'Rourke. He's hilarious.
Well, thank you.
Yes, sir.
Appreciate that.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, like, why do you think that the divorce rate in America shot up so drastically with the baby boomer generation? Like, I know that it was going on beforehand, but, you know, it really became, I guess, almost epidemic with, the 70s and 80s.
With the, what? I'm sorry, I missed the...
The divorce rate.
Oh, the divorce rate. Yeah, we did, because we could.
You had the freedom to do it for the first time.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, there's a lot of stuff the baby boom did that other generations were itching to do and felt for one reason or another, sometimes legal, sometimes moral, sometimes social, that they couldn't do. And when the baby boom, you know, starts to mature, like, so many things that were previously taboo cease to be taboo. And mostly that's a good thing.
Well, you were talking about, being divorced because you could and having a greater amount of freedom. And I've always been impressed that the baby boom generation was also the first that really, marital relationships, coupled relationships, were egalitarian in a way that they had never been before.
They were certainly better. I mean, you know, I think every relationship has got a ways to go on that. That's always a touchy thing. But there certainly is, in general among the baby boom, no prejudice against the, one spouse doesn't have to stay home while the other spouse works. You know, I mean, there's no prejudice against women having career success. You know, there may be a little private resentment in the guy when, you know, his wife is making three times the amount that he is. He wouldn't be a guy if he didn't, you know, have to have a beer and complain to his buddies about that one occasionally. Mm-hmm. But you know, there's it's no big deal. But, on the other hand, our marriages are not as, and I don't say these things are go together, but our marriages are not as stable as our parents' marriages were. And I think maybe we could try a little harder about this.
Let's go on the phone now to Gent in Richardson.
Kent, K-E-N-T.
Oh, Kent. Okay, hi, Kent.
Hey, PJ.
Yeah.
Hey, good to talk to you. Real
good
quick, are you still
man.
Writing pieces for Rolling Stone? And number two, what did you think when you saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan? That's what I want to know.
Thanks for your call.
No, I'm not writing for Rolling Stone anymore. Enough. Here, I just did a piece for AARP magazine, to which we all belong, and the whole baby boom generation now that we're turned 50, and they're revitalizing their magazine. And the editor of the new AARP, the magazine, as it's called, is Bob Love, who was my editor at Rolling Stone.
Wow.
And so Bob and I had a little sort of rueful laugh over that one. How time flies. But, you know, I just, something like Rolling Stone, it's always been aimed at younger people. I know older people read it, but it's been aimed at younger people. And I'd sort of feel out of place, you know. I wouldn't even know what references to make anymore, you know. I got to sort of, generationally speaking, I got to dance with the one that brung me. And Kent had another question there, and I can't,
How you felt when you first saw the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show?
Tuned in? Yes, I was tuned in, as a matter of fact. I was watching it with some friends, and I don't know if we thought anything really extraordinary about it. It was like there was a kind of a 14-year-old girl contingent out there that was, you know, going nuts about the Beatles, and we weren't. We were older. We were like 16. I was in Chicago. I was in high school in Chicago, And Chicago's more of a blues town. We like the Rolling Stones better, and it would be a couple of years before the Rolling Stones would get on the top 40 chart, you know. And they were okay, but, you know, were they better than the Beach Boys? Eh.
Yeah, we had an author on not too long ago who did a book about the early history of the Beatles and the Stones, and sort of the point came out
I saw the review of that book.
Okay, yeah.
I can't remember the title, yeah.
And initially, when they came over, I mean, the audience for the Beatles was like the audience for One Direction today.
Yes, it was. I mean, and so that's why we, as like, you know, macho 16-year-old high school guys, you know, were looking at this a little askance. We liked the music too, but it was a little bit like admitting to liking Justin Bieber.
What do you think that your generation I mean, if you had to name one thing that you've given the world, is it possible to do that?
I'm not sure it's possible to just name one thing, but I think you can kind of say that we really brought an atmosphere of fun and good cheer and goodwill to what is, you know, often a pretty grim world. And for much of the 20th century, the half before us was an unbelievably grim world, you know. And so, you know, I think we brought some humor. I mean, that's certainly a medium of communication today that is the baby boom, you know. I mean, that's us. That starts with, well, I'd like to say National Lampoon because I worked there, but it probably has more to do with the movie Animal House. And I cover Washington a lot. Senator Blutarski is sitting in every seat. You know?
This is the John Belushi character.
Yeah, the John Belushi character, of course, is a horrible mess up, you know, in college. And then when they run the end credits about what happened to everybody, it's Senator Blutarski. Well, it sure is. And as you know, something like The Daily Show, John, I think, maybe just squeaks in as a baby boomer. But not, it's very hard to imagine that without the baby boom. National Lampoon, Saturday Night Live, mm-hmm. even much bigger influence, the Animal House, that John Hughes movies. Yeah, so I suppose if you want to pick one word, it'd be funny.
Hmm.
You know, funny, good, you know, sometimes funny, odd, sometimes funny, haha, but funny, all the time funny.
I have to say, I think, PJ, it's sort of exciting to be on this end of things and know that the baby boom will change the way we conceive old age in this country.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we make everything fun, you know. we'll make, you know,
colonoscopies, all of it.
You bet. You know, I mean, like when I'm of the age. Just had one not long ago, and I went into anesthesiologist who's some 12-year-old. I say, look, you know, I'm a veteran of the 1960s. We're going to do this. He said, oh, you know, I can give you, you know, if you're worried about drugs, I can give you, like, you know, so you can be conscious through the whole. I said, are you kidding me? Worried about drugs? I don't want to know anything about this. You know, I just want to wake up. When it comes to the drugs, don't stint, dude. You know, I will come back and get you.
What do your kids want to know about your childhood that? Is
there anything nothing.
Really?
Well, yeah, they're, you know, kids just aren't interested in their parents. They don't become interested in their parents until they become parents themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Then they become mildly interested. To sort of like, you know, they'll ask their mom what they should do with their kids, just, you know, to be sure to do the exact opposite. And so I don't think... my children live in a baby boom world, but of course, you know, like fish in the sea, they're not aware of the ocean. I mean, they have no curiosity about this. And when I start to go on, so, you know, with the beginning with, when I was your age, you know, you just see their little eyes glaze
over. They
zone out.
You know? Yeah. It does seem, though, and you are an older parent, and it seems like the generations that have followed, parents are, you know, people are waiting longer and longer to have kids. There's something to that.
Yeah, well, we got to be careful about that, you know, because you can wait too long on that thing. And,
yeah.
I didn't know my wife, so I couldn't, I can't go back in time and wish we had done this earlier. We didn't meet, but I wish I'd done it when I had the energy to do it. On the other hand, you know, they're up in the, you know, babies are up in the middle of the night. I'm up in the middle of the night. You know, it sort of works. Yeah.
What do you think that you will leave up to their generation to fix? Your generation? Is it what will the contribution be of the millennials? Can you predict that?
Oh, well, one contribution they're going to make, and they're not going to be too happy about this, is that they got a very big generation followed by a rather smaller generation, baby boom followed by baby bust. And they're going to have to pay our Social Security and our Medicare and these huge sort of welfare programs. I don't mean welfare for poor people. I mean welfare for middle class and rich people. Mm-hmm. Sort of, well, you know, this, we have all these social programs they're going to have to pay for, and they are going to be ticked, you know, at us by the time, you know, I mean, when, you know, when the oldest of us are only 50, it could be another like 40 years they're going to be paying for all this. And all I can say is, A, I'm sorry, and B, no, I'm not going to give I'm not giving them the money back. Actually, government won't even let me. You know, when I turned 65, I had to go on Medicare. But the other thing is, we didn't do it. It was the greatest generation that put these laws in place. Not us, not our fault, as usual.
P.J. O'Rourke's new book is called The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault, and I'll Never Do It Again. P.J., it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you. You're very welcome. It's a pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canaby. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.